Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined today by author Sam Quinones. He's a journalist and from Los Angeles who has probably written one of the best and greatest books on the opioid epidemic that has come out. And to give you a background on it, it's a book that, one, if you've been to any of my talks, you've heard me talk about it. I don't know how many of the books we've sold, but I'm sure that he doesn't realize that, but we've probably sold thousands of them just from talking about it, because the big thing for it is that it demonstrates and talks about the opioid epidemic from the viewpoint of a journalist, not from somebody in healthcare, not from somebody in the drug industry, not from anything else. And so I think it adds credibility as somebody who dug into it and found out the roots of the history of the problem and how it developed in a way that it's incredibly well written. So if you have not checked out that book, you need to pick that up. If you're like me, the audiobook did just great for my trips to and from the emergency department. So we wanted to talk to him. I've been trying to catch up with him for a while, and he is, of course, a very busy man with lots of writing going on. So Mr. Quinones, thanks for joining us here on the front line.
It's my pleasure, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And so tell us, how did your background being LA Times 2004 to 2014, 2013, you took the break to kind of put Dreamland together. Kind of talk about that process and how it came together.
Well, I had already written a story about these heroin traffickers for the LA Times out of a small state in Mexico, the state of Nayarit in Mexico. And I thought that that's where the story kind of ended. But as I got farther into it, I began to realize that their story, the reason the heroin traffickers were all of a sudden doing banner business in the United States, and these guys were at the vanguard of that, is that there was this change in American medicine. Now, I knew nothing about that. I knew a lot about Mexico. I had lived in Mexico for 10 years. I've written two books about Mexico, both while available on Amazon. I had spent 10 years as a freelance writer down there. I covered a lot about it. I've written been to most of the states of Mexico. And I knew a lot about Mexico, but I was in Mexico when this whole pain revolution in American medicine took place. I was oblivious to that completely. I did not know anything about it. This was, of course, the revolution in pain management that held that we're a country in an epidemic of pain, that we were doing very poor job, meanwhile, of treating pain. The pain needed to be far more aggressively treated, and it's too bad because we did have the tools, but doctors were afraid to use them, and those tools were opioid painkillers. And so I, this is what I learned later. I didn't know anything about this. I really didn't even know what Vicodin was, say, or OxyContin. Didn't know any of that, what oxycodone was. This was all new for me. This was like a learning curve that was very steep. But I began to realize this was essential. I couldn't write about heroin in America without writing first about how this revolution got going. And the doctors, meanwhile, had been pushed and pressured and cajoled, and some accepted this eagerly and others went very reluctantly. But a lot of doctors began prescribing opioid painkillers for all manner of pain, and in huge doses, almost unending doses, particularly after acute, post-op, post-surgery, where you know you're going to have pain for 3 days and you were getting 30 days worth of pills. Of course, the ERs were a major place where these were being dispensed because they were, the easiest access for people who were looking for pills. You go in and you began to hear stories of people harming themselves to be able to get pain pills, that kind of thing. But whatever happened, all the reasons for this, what happened was an enormous new supply of narcotics was unleashed for years, year after year after year, beginning in the mid-1990s on the American public, which demanded it, I think, in a lot of ways, wanted their pain, its pain assuaged completely, no pain being the new standard that everyone was holding doctors to and this kind of thing. And so all of that, though, was part of the story that I did not understand when I started writing about the heroin guys. And I came to understand on the road, so to speak, towards understanding why heroin traffickers were doing such new business. Of course, a lot of people did grow addicted to these pills. A lot of people couldn't afford the pills, lost their insurance, or simply wanted a bigger boost, and they switched eventually to heroin because these pills are, you know, oxycodone, hydrocodone, are opioids and chemically cousins, essentially, to heroin. And so that was the connection that was very clear between American medicine and its new prescribing practices and the rise of the heroin trafficking from Mexico. That's really how this book began.
What I love about it is the fact that, you know, I know medicine from the medical side, from emergency medicine and the way we were pushed. I still remember, I grew up in East Tennessee, currently live in Lexington, Kentucky. Your book is based out of Portsmouth, Ohio, which is just honestly about an hour and 15 minutes up the road from me. And, you know, the number of times I've been in and around that area, that other physicians have been in and around that area, and understanding the complexities. One thing I love about the book is that, you know, it takes what I know as a physician and the pressures that we were under, you know, letters going to groups that said our pain scores are down, we need to write more pain medicines, we need to, you know, make sure you're giving people what they want, all the way to the point of, you know, bringing in those other factors. You know, one of my favorite things that you talk about and that you uncover and discuss is the, and I think I've even got the phrasing right, the economic coping strategy of opioids in the Appalachian region, where we've seen that. In a little bit of way, it is clearly a testament of how well you really dug into this topic as somebody from LA on the West Coast and here living and growing up in the Appalachian region for the majority of my life, understanding how this stuff impacts and what happens when you lose industry. And that's what happened in Portsmouth, Ohio, is the loss of industry, you know, whatever that may be, the loss of the coal industry, the amount of physical labor that people are under, the amount of chronic pain that people are under, and really digging into that and understanding why areas like this are impacted so much more than other places. But honestly, there's no place that's been protected. Were you surprised when you really uncovered this whole system and this whole reality of the rural areas of Appalachia in the way that chronic pain and economic downturn and the changes in the healthcare system really fueled this problem?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about Appalachia other than what every American might know, you know, very little. And, you know, it was just from talking with local folks and that you come to understand how this all takes place. And that I think the reason that the pharma companies began to really focus their promotional efforts in those regions was they had data showing that doctors were already, long before the opioid thing, were already prescribing a lot of different kinds of pills of all kinds to people, because that was about the only thing that the doctors could do for a lot of people, given that what people were really coming to them for was a kind of an economic pain. They were in physical pain, but it was probably more the economic issue that they were trying to deal with. And I think the doctors saw this, didn't know what else to do. So diet pills and a variety of other things, benzodiazepines, et cetera, all these kinds of pills began to be prescribed. And I think pharma companies saw the data. And so these doctors are already prescribing a lot. And so let's market to them first, because they're already behind the idea that the way they deal with their patients is through pills. Largely, I took it because there was no other option that they oftentimes had, or sometimes the people themselves were so demanding that they wanted these things that doctors kind of just had no choice but kind of to go along. And then you marshal that together with the vast power of pharma companies to market, to when they really want to get things going, they start doing it. And of course, during those years, another issue that's very big that hit that area really hard was a revolution in pharmaceutical sales that was going on. Before this, there was a very long period, decades, in which pharma salesmen, and they were almost all men, were slow-moving, older guys, not terribly given to the hard sell. Almost all of them were former doctors or pharmacists, so they knew what they were talking about. They were real sources of information for the doctor. As medicine began to change very fast, what effect will this pill have when taken with that pill? Doctor may not know, but the docs could ask these guys, and these guys were very aware of their position in the community. Almost all of them were from the community. They didn't, you know, they were at churches, they were at football games, and chamber of commerce meeting, and so they wanted to make sure that there was some accountability, let's say, built into the system. In the 1990s, all that changed, you know. All those guys left pushed out, forced to retire. They were older guys already. And in their place came a whole battalion of younger folks, handsome, good-looking women now, a lot of women, and young. Not a lot of them had any background in pharmacy or in medicine, but they did have a background in sales. So they didn't know what they were selling, but they did know how to sell. And this, too, I believe, was a crucial moment in all this. That once these folks were unleashed in huge numbers, far dwarfing the numbers that used to be the case, they had an enormous influence and a very aggressive sales, huge bonuses paid by Purdue, which put out OxyContin. They were so important in all this, it seems to me, because they were relentless. They were always chipper. They were always giving stuff away, which is how you sell people on certain ideas. Just give them a lot of stuff, and pretty soon they think you're just a wonderful person. They go along with whatever you say. All of these kinds of factors were also a big part of this, I think. And you saw that in the Appalachia, Southern Ohio, Eastern Kentucky, et cetera, all these different places where they became such a big influence on doctors who were, of course, under siege from their patients, who were demanding help for their pain, quick fixes to their pain, didn't have a lot of time because now it was managed care and 10, 12, 13 minutes a patient, you know, that kind of thing. All of this was part of the influence of the factors that went into how we got where we are today.
Let's talk about a little bit of that, because, you know, you talked about the Appalachian aspect of things, and, you know, a little story I can share in terms of that expectation is small town American. It's not necessarily even Appalachia, even though this story was Appalachia. It was, my dad was a vascular surgeon, and he, you know, growing up moonlighting as a resident in a small town in North Georgia at the base of the Appalachian chain in Rome, Georgia, and following up with a physician he worked for, he would man the clinic and the hospital on the weekend. This was even before they had emergency departments. And the physician had a jar of blue pills, a jar of red pills, and a jar of white pills. And every patient got some of them. It really didn't matter what the pills were. He said he thinks some were aspirin, some were prednisone. As the physician that was there called him, prednidone was what he would hand out. And my dad, being somebody at that point who was going with evidence-based medicine, was like, you don't need this, you don't need that. And he gets a call the next week from the physician and says, Dr. Paul, this is the expectation. And if you're going to ever work here in this clinic again, you're going to make sure people get their pills that they need, because that's their expectation when they come in. And that's exactly, and as soon as you started talking about that, I could just remember that story as my dad tells it over the years of Northern Georgia in that small clinic at that point. I was recently in Rome, Georgia, and that made me think of that as, well, a great, beautiful little city, but the whole mindset. But the whole book, and what I think is interesting about the book and the story of the opioid epidemic, is it's probably one of the better examples of the error chain or the Swiss cheese model of a disaster in which so many things came together at the same time. And I want to get a little bit of that out of you. The first is the change in the way the United States addressed pain. And there was a lot of things to go about, and a lot of the book was about that. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think part of it was you had in pain management people who went in for very idealistic reasons. Doctors who went into thinking this was the reason you became a doctor, was to cure people's pain. What other reason was there, you know? And seeing that we didn't do a very good job of it, you know, that's one thing. And very leery of the attitude that we should never use pain pills because this was a good way to perform that mission, you know. At the same time, I believe that managed care was a big thing. Again, you no better way to end an appointment than for the doc to pull out the prescription pad, right? Mm-hmm. And as you say, I think in many areas, you didn't have a successful visit if you didn't get something, whatever it might be, some kind of prescription. And then I really believe, too, that an essential part of this, all these things are essential to the story, but and together they don't really happen. The thing doesn't happen without them. But it was the Americans' idea that we could have our pain cured completely, and we wanted it done quickly, and we were entitled to a life free of pain. We wanted quick fix. One guy said, I think it was very aptly put, we began to treat doctors as car mechanics in our bodies with the cars. We'd bring it in and fix me, doc. And when the doctor would try to be really, the doctor's role is to be an educator, to educate us on how best to care for our bodies. When the doctor would try to perform that role and say, you know, the thing is, you don't really need these pills. What you really need is to, well, let's say, stop drinking, stop smoking, eat better food, get more exercise, swim, you know, a variety of things that have to do with us doing the job, us doing the work. Increasingly, as a culture, of course, as a whole, we began to push back and say, no, you fix us, you fix us. Some people, of course, are very much into their own health and wellness. But as a culture, doctors began to feel this. One doc said, I knew we were in trouble once I began to see people come to me for pills to take care of symptoms of the common cold. Like, nobody wanted to wait. Everyone wanted to just big dose me and get me done. And there was this attitude that there was a pill for almost anything. And I believe that this attitude, which grew very strong, and then when you have those pain numbers, those pain scales, and the pain evaluations, and the doctor evaluations by patients, that was really a big part of it. Those things were very damaging when it came to this, I believe. A real way of extorting pills from docs was to say, did the doctor treat your pain well? And the answer is no, because he didn't give me the pills I wanted. Well, pretty soon the doc is going to give you the pills you want. And because your hospital or your clinic is not getting the pain scores that they feel they need, or the Medicaid or Medicare or JCO or whoever decides are necessary. And so all of this was part of it, though. You had to have that attitude on the part of patients. Patients had to be demanding, because there was a very strong tradition in American medicine, I think, among a lot of docs, to be the educator, to be a bulwark. And that got withered away through pain management, through managed care, but also, I think, from just relentless exposure to patients who demanded to be fixed. And I just think all of those things are so crucial. You can't really have what we had in this country without those things combined. So when people want me to, who's most to blame? I think I've got that question. Apart from what's the solution, the other question that I get most often is, who's most to blame? And I say, well, a journalist's job at times is to apportion blame. Really, a lot of times it's to say, this is the story. You figure it out. You figure out who you think is most to blame. I'm not to be the judge here. I'm just trying to tell the story as best I can with the facts that I've been able to assemble. And I think that but all of that together is what created the situation that we're now in. One other thing also was crucial in all this, and very important to mention, and that is the role of insurance companies. Insurance companies stopped reimbursing for non-opioid pain treatment, right? So it used to be that you would have a doctor would, for pain, would prescribe a variety of things. Only one of them was opioid painkillers. It might be a lot of physical therapy, occupational therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, marital counseling, job therapy, all these different things. And most of those would be reimbursed by the insurance company. But as the pills took over, well, now insurance companies began to say, why are we reimbursing for this and this? And then they began to cut back on that. And so soon the doctor was all alone with the patient with a mandate to cure America's pain, kind of, and pressure from the patient, and only had one tool, and that was the opioid painkiller. And so all of that, we have paid a lot of attention to drug companies in the last 2-3 years. Since the book came out, when I was writing the book, there were 3 lawsuits against drug companies. Now there are 2,000. Okay, so I remember very clearly when I was writing the book, and this was not a tool that people were using, and now it's a tool people are using. But we have yet to really pay much attention to the insurance companies. I think their role is crucial.
I love the fact that you know, people are asking those questions. Often when they ask what is the main cause, they're really trying to figure out how to make it somebody else's problem. And, you know, I think one of the realities is, and I think that talking about it from the error chain or the Swiss cheese model, if you don't know what that is, it really came from aviation. Really, the idea comes that most plane crashes don't happen because of one problem. They come because of a series of problems. And if you had one thing differently or a couple of things that happened different, the crash may have never happened. And that's where I feel like with this, there are so many different contributions. And as healthcare, as a physician myself in the emergency department, we have to take our role. We did not stand up for evidence-based medicine. And you can't use this phrase because apparently it's probably taken by one of the office supply companies, but the easy button, with being able to hit the easy button anytime a patient came in, and you've already mentioned it, you know, the ability to get somebody to shut up and out your door by writing a prescription. And it still persists today to the point that I'm writing people for their Tylenol and their ibuprofen and their eye drops and their over-the-counter allergy medicines just because the American mindset that I have to have some sort of prescription. And you've talked about the evolution and the thought that everybody deserves to be pain-free that came out in the late 90s and early 2000s really impacted it, as well as even touching on the drug industry. And I think that is a huge one. And then you've referenced Arthur Sackler and Purdue Pharmaceuticals, which is the head of this monster when it comes to the drug industry. But honestly, there's a lot of players in that as well.
One of the things that I thought was interesting was the idea that these pills were virtually non-addictive had a corollary. And the corollary is that if they're virtually non-addictive, it doesn't matter how many of them you prescribe. And so one of the things that grew out of this that I actually had an encounter with was that you would get enormous amounts of pills after every surgery. So a surgery that would leave you with pain that everybody knew would last you only 3 days, you would still get 30 days worth of hydrocodone, Vicodin or whatever, or OxyContin. And I got my appendix out and, you know, 2 Vicodin a day, which was pretty much good. That's a good thing. I'd just been cut open after all. But then they gave me 30 days worth of Vicodin to take home, take as needed. That was another addition. And we had 49, I think, million surgeries every year, routine surgeries. Well, you multiply that by 20 years and you get where we're a pretty far way down the road where we're going.
And 75% of people's first usage of opioid-based pain medications comes from a family medicine cabinet. And what you're referencing there was the 1980 New England Journal of Medicine article, which you talk about in the book. The port is called Porter and Jick, where they come in and say in this 12,000 folks they monitored in the hospital, closely monitored, there was minimal risk of opioid addiction. And that's what Purdue Pharma used to really push forward OxyContin as a non-addictive medication. And what's interesting, you know, you talked about the number of pills written. It's just recently that hospitals are reviewing that system. And, you know, my hospital is now reviewing the pain medications associated postoperatively, then interviewing the patients to see how much they actually used. And an example is with a laparoscopic cholecystectomy, so gallbladder removal, the average number of pain pills that was written was somewhere between 35 and 40, and the average number that patients were taking was 8. And so you're talking about that increased number that was now sitting around the house. That's the opportunity for other family members to get to, for the opportunity for theft and for violence and things like that. And so hospitals are finally starting to catch up. And it's 2019. And we're, you know, just now really taking those steps. And you talked about the pain satisfaction scores, and it's just been within the last year or two that there's been the question of should that question be removed, and it has been tooled some, but I know there's still a how well was her pain managed in most evaluations that are sent to the families. And so, you know, we're not completely through that.
My problem is that this has been that with those evaluations is when you tie them to enough negative answers and you're going to get fired or you're going to lose some privileges or you're going to lose a, you know, we're going to dock your pay or whatever happens. That's when it becomes a real problem. And all those pills that people are prescribed, like I was prescribed 60 Vicodin. I took 58 pills were hanging around in my medicine cabinet for 4 years till I began this project. And that's when I began to realize what they'd actually given me. I didn't know what Vicodin was. I took it, I thought it was like Tylenol or something like that, because I got no explanation. That's where you account for the enormous surge in the black market that was out there. People selling or having stolen, whatever, the pills that they were prescribed in excess, you know. And of course, some of it was from hospice care patients who had enormous amounts of these pills when they died on hand. But I think a lot of it came from this whole idea that we could prescribe huge amounts of pills and it didn't matter because they were non-addictive. And the main reason was they were prescribed for this routine surgery like appendectomy, was the doctor didn't want to see the patient again, didn't want to have another call, you know, over the weekend. Oh man, I'm in pain again, can you give me more, you know? So just prescribe way more than they need, and it's fine because they're non-addictive, you know, so it doesn't matter.
What's funny is even last year I had an elbow surgery performed and the doctor said, what medicine do you want me to write for you postoperatively? And I said, naproxen, basically because I want something that I can take twice a day, an anti-inflammatory NSAID. And he seemed surprised. He said, you don't want anything? I said, no, I don't want anything around. I don't want to have that. And honestly, pain is a protective mechanism. If it hurts, it's because I shouldn't do something. It tells me that I'm not supposed to do this movement or lift this object or do these things. with the anti-inflammatories, research after research. In fact, right before we got on this phone call, an alert comes across my computer that says NSAIDs more effective than opioids in, and I didn't even read it, but I'm sure, you know, it seems like story after story now. It's taken us 20 years to get back to evidence-based medicine, that we already had the tools right there, but somehow we fell victim of a bunch of different things that said this was going to be the answer. Moving kind of forward in the book, you know, that translation, you know, everybody was surprised when there was laws across the country with opioid prescribing, prescription drug monitoring programs, things like that, and yet the deaths continued to rise. And that was because the transition that opioids produce their own need. They produce their own demand with increasing levels that are necessary to maintain normal. It's not really necessarily a high, it's just maintaining normal. And your history of understanding Nayarit in Mexico in that area really kind of got you into that transition of how we got from the opioid prescription epidemic to where we are now with heroin. And there's, you know, just get a little tidbits in terms of, you know, some of those things that you noticed.
Well, I'd say that the other crucial thing that we did not talk about earlier, and essential to explain where we are today, is that we saw a major shift in our heroin markets well before the opioid thing got going. So in the 1980s, you remember in the 1970s, or maybe I don't know how old you are, but I do, I would watch these great movies from New York City, French Connection 1 and 2, Serpico, Prince of the City, all these great movies. They were about heroin, and they always went through New York City, and that is because most of our heroin came from the Far East for decades, right? For decades. So when it came through New York, came from Turkey or Afghanistan or Burma or whatever, and came through New York City, crossed two continents on an ocean, and got to New York City. From there, was funneled out to Cleveland or Boston or wherever it went, right? And that's the way it was for a long time. And it got here very expensive because it had so far to go, and very weak, right? And so we didn't really have the numbers of fatalities we're seeing today. But in the 80s, all that changed. The Latin American groups, Colombian cartels, and the Mexicans were coming up behind them, took over that and began to funnel into the United States along with cocaine and marijuana or whatever. Heroin as well. That heroin got here very, very cheap, every year cheaper, and every year more potent. And nobody noticed because no one cared about heroin. Heroin was not the big issue. Crack was the big issue. Then methamphetamine was a big, I mean, we did not have a burgeoning, exploding number of opiate addicts in America during the late 80s, early 1990s. It wasn't until this whole thing with the doctors and the opioid painkillers, all that, then we began to see that happen. But by then, that transition of our heroin market was a fait accompli. It had happened. We just, only people who recognized it was the DEA. And so what ended up happening was people began to look for cheaper alternatives. They went to the streets, and that huge new black market created by that vast, vast new supply annually unleashed on the American public of opioid painkillers was a bit, some chunk of that was out there creating this black market. But those pills were very, very expensive. So if you were doing 150, 200 milligrams of opioids a day, you're going to have to pay $1 a milligram. That was 150, 200 bucks a day. Couldn't afford that. And increasingly, people began to turn to heroin because it was now as potent, if not more so, because of this historic change I told you about. And it was cheaper than ever. It was certainly much, much cheaper than the pills, a fifth the price, pretty much. And it was the no-brainer. So you began to see people understand that shift had happened, even if they didn't really know it, and turn to heroin, which was more plentiful, cheaper, and more potent than ever in the history of our country because of where most of the heroin was now coming from, Latin America, Colombia, but then increasingly now today, virtually all Mexico. We awakened this new supply in a sense. When I lived in Mexico and I lived down there 10 years, cartels and drug trafficking groups wanted to do marijuana always, of course, but really it was cocaine, methamphetamine was a big thing. It was not a lot of people who wanted to traffic heroin as viewed as a very scuzzy drug. Nobody really cared about it. And it wasn't until we up here with our new supplies of opioids unleashed every year by drug companies, doctors, the whole thing we talked about earlier. It was only when that happened that people began to, down in Mexico, say, oh, gee, new market up there, new day, let's get into heroin. The poppy cultivation explodes. And then, of course, bringing it up to date, people begin to figure out, why are we growing poppies? Let's make fentanyl. or let's buy it from the Chinese. The Chinese will provide this for us. Heroin is actually, of all the major illicit drugs up to that point, heroin is the easiest. You get greater bang for your buck when you traffic heroin because it's so condensable and so easy to traffic, much more so than cocaine or meth or marijuana. Fentanyl is even 10 times more, is not only 10 times more potent than heroin, it's 10 times easier to traffic. And so that's the situation we now find ourselves in. You know, a great pain-killing drug like fentanyl, a stalwart drug that's been used for since the 1960s, it has been perverted very much because drug trafficking groups figured it out, how to make it and the importance of how it would be a fantastic substitute for heroin.
And interestingly, one, you know, and I don't want to give away everything that's in the book. I want people to, if you haven't listened or read the book at this point, you need to read it. It's the purposeful, and you talk about it in depth, why there was a significant targeting of Middle America, especially focusing on Columbus, Ohio, but spreading from there in terms of Middle America. And I thought it was very fascinating in terms of the way folks approached, the way that it was approached, the new mindset. And when I do talks, I like to talk about the fact that it was almost the Chick-fil-A satisfaction, customer satisfaction aspect of medicine, and, you know, and or drug at that point. And so that's something that's very important that I think you need to look into. You can dig into that aspect of things. And at this point, I'm looking forward to what's next. You mentioned that you're actually at this point working on some other projects related to Dreamland. And what's coming up and what can we expect?
Well, over the summer, we're coming out with a young adult version of Dreamland, largely because I think Dreamland originally is a pretty thick book. And sometimes kids from like 8th to 12th grade have a little bit of trouble with it. But also because I think it's important that they understand this story deeply. And we've been hearing kind of requests for this for a bit. So we figured let's come out with a version that is geared towards from 8th to 12th grade that tells the story not in as complex a style, a much shorter version also. It's about half the size of Dreamland, basically. But it's really an attempt to explain to kids who are coming up that this is what awaits them, and they got to be very, very cognizant of this. The day of recreational drug use in America, I believe, is now over because the drugs are so unforgiving. The pot is hyperpotent. Meth, all these kinds. Now, then the other thing I'm working on, the YA version, the young adult version comes out in July of Dreamland, called Dreamland, just the young adult version. And that comes out in July, and I'm hoping that this will be a book that libraries and schools, primarily parenting groups, you know, that kind of the youth recreation groups will find important to use. Then I'm currently working on a follow-up to Dreamland, which has to do with the rise of fentanyl. And also now the explosion of methamphetamine that we're seeing. Methamphetamine and heroin don't usually go in the same sentence in the drug world. Different groups use them, different groups abuse them, and they're not the same people. But in this case, what you're seeing is that meth is now being marketed to people who are opiate addicts and as a kind of the next stage in the story. So it's really part of the same story. But also part of that book, very importantly, I think, is an attempt to tell some of the stories of grassroots response to this epidemic. So what is happening at the most local, most granular level in response to this? And I think that's also extraordinarily important and very exhilarating. For me, it's very inspirational to see some of these things that are taking place. And it all gets back to one idea that we need to be working in small, incremental, daily kind of workings towards a larger group of solutions, rather than think that we have one miraculous solution that will take care of all our problems. To me, it's such an important thing to work in those ways, to understand that that's what got us into this, that we wanted one miraculous solution for this very, very complicated thing. The question of what to do about human pain is very complicated. We got one thing, hallelujah, it's a pill for everybody and all our troubles will be solved. Well, it got us into this mess that we are now in. And I believe that the way we get out is through community building, people working together, coming together and working on small solutions together, putting them all together, various solutions, not one. And so that's really what the next book is going to be about. Fentanyl and meth on one hand, grassroots solutions and daily work, basically, on the other. And I think that's kind of where we are as a country when it comes to this epidemic, but also when it comes to a lot of other things, how to improve communities, how communities rebound from economic devastation too. I think this is all part of the same issue. It's all part of the same story.
You actually answered my last question right there, and that's fantastic. So for everybody listening, if you haven't checked out Dreamland, he's got a lot of works, but from us in healthcare, I think Dreamland is honestly a mainstay and a must hear or read book on the evolution of the opioid crisis. Because being in healthcare, you're going to have a clearly narrowed focus as to the issue and what happened. And it's very important to understand the number of factors that came together in order for us not only to get out of this epidemic, but also to prevent this in the future. Because I think it's a point where, you know, taking the blame from a healthcare standpoint, that we fell asleep at the wheel and let other people determine our actions, our behaviors, and in the way we practice medicine. And as physicians and other providers of medicine, we can't fall victim to that. We have to continue to keep our scientific minds in check and make sure that what we are doing is going to be the most evidence-based. And unfortunately, it came at the cost of hundreds of thousands of American lives. For us to get back to this and to, you know, hopefully get through the opioid epidemic. But as I tell folks at talks, if we don't address addiction, we don't provide recovery and support for these folks, all we're going to do is change the substance. And that's exactly, Sam, what you've been talking about with the methamphetamines, is the fact that, you know, they don't seem like they have a connection. But what I'm seeing in this area right now, especially north and south of here in Ohio and Tennessee, is that the methamphetamines are the next big thing that are quickly taking over the set of addiction and what we're seeing in the emergency department. So we as emergency physicians and other folks in the healthcare arena need to make sure that we are there and understand what's going on so we can do the best that we can for our patients. So check it out, Dreamland. It's available everywhere. You can get on Amazon, you can get on iTunes. That's the way I got it off of iTunes, is the book version, the audio version. And you can get it anywhere. It's a must read, must listen for everybody in healthcare to understand everything that's going on. And we've been talking with Sam Quinones, the author of that book. He's got some great stuff coming up. I will make sure that I am one of the first in line when it comes to being able to get that book and listen to the next connection in what's going on. And Sam, I appreciate your time with us today.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Ryan. Great to be with you.
And you can check him out. He's got his own page there, samquinones.com, with a lot of information there. But also, if you just search Dreamland, and if you get anywhere close to his name, you're going to find the book and the audio that we're talking about. As for me, I invite your comments and suggestions, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, @everydaymed on Twitter. And of course, make sure that you are subscribed to the ASAP Frontline podcast so you get every great episode that we have, especially these with special guests such as Mr. Quinones, who's really driven a lot of the way I educate and approach pain management and medicine. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and you've been listening to ASAP Frontline.